You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. The federal government has raised the legal age to buy tobacco and vaping products to 21, up from 18. But the rub here is that without changes in Wisconsin laws, local law enforcement officers are not able to properly enforce the new mandate. And the laws on the books in Wisconsin say the minimum age to buy tobacco or vape products is 18. Do you support raising the age to 21? Would you rather see Wisconsin follow state law here? What questions do you have about e-cigarettes and access to paraphernalia? We're at 800-642-1234. Jenna Flynn is health educator at the Marathon County Health Department. She coordinates the Central Wisconsin Tobacco-Free Coalition. Jenna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, so this new federal law is different from current state law. So which tobacco law should Wisconsin be following right now?
So the new federal law raises the legal age to purchase tobacco from 18 to 21, and that means that it is effective immediately for all states, including Wisconsin, whether or not the state statute is updated or not.
How much power does local law enforcement have to really enforce the new federal tobacco law since Wisconsin doesn't have an updated age to 21?
Right now, the U.S. Federal Drug Administration, FDA, are the ones that are going to be responsible for the enforcement of the law. So that's really who's going to be in charge of enforcement until state statute is updated.
Are other states in the same situation as Wisconsin?
You know, it really depends on the state. Some states already updated their law to be tobacco 21 before the federal law passed. And some states have different rules in terms of what locals can enforce or not enforce. For example, some states can update their local ordinances very easily to allow local law enforcement to be able to enforce. Wisconsin just doesn't have that in place.
Well, Jenna, let's look at the retail level. If a retailer in Wisconsin is selling tobacco to someone underage now, what type of consequences could come with that?
So that is a that goes back to the FDA. So because they're the ultimate enforcement agency, we really don't know what their plans are in terms of enforcement. But we do know that they do have a program where there are inspectors throughout the state that monitor sales of tobacco products to minors or those under the age of 21 now in this case. So it's really up to them in terms of what their enforcement plan is at this time.
In Marathon County, where you are, some retailers have reached out to you because they're confused about whether to follow federal or state law. What concerns have they brought to your attention?
So ultimately, you know, at first when this law came out, it was confusing for retailers because all of a sudden, you know, they have to comply with a law that's effective immediately and they didn't, you know, get a lot of heads up with it. So we want to help them understand what that law is and what they need to do to comply. And a lot of the questions were around, like, when is it effective? And the answer goes back to that it was effective immediately as soon as President Trump signed it in.
So you recently sent out a mailer containing information on the new tobacco age to retailers in your area. What information did you convey there?
Yes. So the Central Wisconsin Tobacco Free Coalition sent out a mailer that included, like, frequently asked questions about Tobacco 21. And I'm not sure if we'll talk about this, but the new flavor restriction law as well, just like a Q&A document, and then also visual images of what the restrictions are for the flavors in terms of products. Because ultimately, you know, retailers in Marathon County, and I think the majority of the state, want to follow the laws. They're not trying to break state statute or federal law or anything, but they need to be able to understand what the rules are. So that's where the frustration has been coming in, at least on our end, is just calls like, you know, coming from a place of concern of ultimately, you know, we want to follow the rules, but we don't know what to do type of thing.
We're talking with Jenna Flynn. She's health educator at the Marathon County Health Department, where she coordinates the Central Wisconsin Tobacco-Free Coalition. You can join in. Have you tried to buy tobacco products lately? Did the retailer enforce the 21 minimum age law from the federal government? Are you a retailer? Are you confused by the federal and state tobacco laws? Join in 800-642-1234. 1234 email ideas at WPR.org. Jenna, you had mentioned that 42% of high schoolers in Marathon County have attempted to quit smoking. That now includes that gray area between 18 and 21 who may already be addicted to smoking. In your opinion, what added support does there need to be for people right now, especially young people, around tobacco products?
So we know that nicotine is highly addictive, and unfortunately, a large majority of tobacco users start before the age of 18 and even before the age of 21. I have a statistic here that according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, 80% of adult smokers started before they turned 18, and nearly 95% started before the age of 21. So there's definitely a gap of people out there that do need resources to help quit their nicotine addiction, especially if they're unable to purchase the products. So here in Wisconsin, we have the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line, which is an excellent resource that anyone can access free of charge. If it is a minor, they have to be 13 years of age or older, but it's a great option for people that, if they're ready to quit or they're even thinking about it, they can talk to a quit coach, they can get a couple weeks of free medication, and they can work with this individual to try to ultimately quit.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Liam is joining us from Eau Claire this morning. Hi, Liam.
Hi.
What would you like to say?
I am in a class called documentary theater at my high school, and we are writing a performance that is based around the use of e-cigarettes and vape products. And it gives a lot of factual information while kind of encouraging people to stop. It centers around three characters who are in high school and kind of focuses on some of the problems with e-cigarettes and vaping.
Wow. Liam, what aspect of this performance are you a part of? Did you help write it? Are you acting?
I helped write it, and I may be acting in this performance. It's going to be kind of based in like a video format. We're going to do a couple videos around town in the school to kind of present this.
And what do you see among your friends in high school around vaping?
Last year, quite a few people did vape or use nicotine products, and I've seen it everywhere, in classrooms, in bathrooms, several places. But recently, since the sicknesses started getting worse and people started dying, a lot of people have actually quit, which it's been very good.
Liam, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that the work on your high school's documentary. Jenna Flynn, Liam was seeing vaping everywhere, but the recent health scares have young people concerned.
Yes, and that's definitely a concern from our public health perspective as well. There's some misconceptions around that, and that a lot of people had said, well, these illnesses have only been related to products that people have made homemade, or they've only been related to products that have THC or marijuana in them. And that's just not true. According to the data that we do have, there has been some information that tells us that some of these products, some of the illnesses have been related to just plain nicotine. In fact, on Good Morning America recently, there was a story of a 17-year-old who received a double lung transplant due to vaping. And he spoke out about that recently.
Jenna Flynn is the Marathon County Health Department's health educator. We're talking about tobacco products and e-cigarettes. Have you tried to buy tobacco products recently? Did the retailer enforce the 18 or 21 minimum age law? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jenna Flynn here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about access to tobacco and e-cigarettes. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association sent a letter to state legislative leaders nearly 3 weeks ago asking for state laws to be changed to allow law enforcement to effectively enforce the new federal age minimum to buy tobacco and vaping products. Federal government raised the legal age to purchase tobacco and vaping products to 21. Wisconsin's minimum age stands at 18. Are you a retailer? Are you confused by the federal and state tobacco laws? What questions do you have? Have you put up new signage to reflect the federal law? Join in 800-642-1234. And Marathon County's health educator, Jenna Flynn, stays with us. She coordinates the Central Wisconsin Tobacco-Free Coalition. Let's go back to the phones now. Doug is joining us from Fontana this morning. Hi, Doug.
Good morning.
Good morning. What do you see out of these tobacco laws?
Well, I find the hypocrisy rich that our federal government can send our 18-year-olds to endless war in the Middle East, allow them to purchase handguns and assault rifles, yet they want to put a layer of law or government upon an 18, 19, 20-year-old, yet all the while claiming to be against a larger government. And by the way, I am opposed to any kind of tobacco product. If you're going to take it away from everyone.
Doug, thank you for the call. Jenna, you know, Doug is opposed there to this idea that the federal government is imposing restrictions at this younger age when they are able, the federal government is able to, have less restriction or more restrictions elsewhere. Jenna?
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Doug. So this is a topic that has come up often. And, you know, I've actually thought about it myself coming from a family of veterans that, that is a good point that, you know, there are people, folks that are fighting for our country that are 18. And yet, you know, this is something that addresses 21-year-olds and under. However, I will say that, to me, it does feel like comparing apples to oranges because, you know, this is a product that it's the number one cause of preventable death and disease. And unfortunately, veterans have been a population that has been historically targeted by tobacco companies in the past. So, you know, it's really looking at youth prevention and ultimately helping our youth and our younger people be healthier because, we want to prevent a whole new generation from becoming addicted to nicotine.
You had mentioned earlier the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, announcing it would ban the sale of fruit and mint-flavored e-cigarette cartridges, and that includes pods or these pod-based systems. Can you describe for us what these are and what the FDA is banning?
Sure. So the flavor ban relates to pod-based systems and cartridges. So it only addresses these products. So, for example, a product similar to Juul takes pod-based cartridges. So those are the flavors that will be banned. So it does not address e-liquids that are actually in the e-liquid containers.
Okay.
So those, I mean, there's thousands of flavors out there. Those will not be addressed at this time. And then there's also an exemption of cartridges that are tobacco flavored and menthol flavored. And we know historically that menthol has been a very attractive flavor to some disparate populations that have been affected by tobacco. And I do want to add, too, that some of the actual devices that we've seen in the school districts, even here in Marathon County, that have been confiscated are still going to be out on the market. So it does not get at that either.
Let's bring in Rory now, joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Rory.
Good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to share?
Yeah, I'm a registered nurse and nurse educator, and although I certainly support the need for more regulations regarding tobacco and vaping products, especially to minors, I feel that the federal legislation was rolled out far too suddenly and doesn't put in place any support for those currently addicted. I'm a mother of an addicted 20-year-old vaper. She's been turned away from buying vaping products here in Eau Claire, which is a good thing, but now she must either turn to unsupported withdrawal symptoms or solicit illegally obtained products from friends. My daughter suffers from anxiety and depression and became addicted to vaping products 2 years ago legally to help her cope with those symptoms. Now she's kind of caught in the middle of addiction and illegal use.
Rory, thank you for sharing your story. Jenna, what do those support systems look like, and how is the Department of Health Services working to educate families?
Yeah, thanks, Rory. That's a really important point that you bring up, and that's our concern as well as coordinators and coalitions across the state and the Department of Health Services. We want to be able to help because ultimately the users, the people with addictions, they're not the enemies, right? They're battling through this, and they want and need the supports to ultimately quit their nicotine addiction, and there's this gap. So like I said, going back to the quit line, I'm definitely an advocate for that, and I think that's a good starting point as our Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line. And also for parents, especially for young users, there's a great resource on the Department of Health Services website. It's called the Tobacco is Changing campaign. And this is a great way for parents and youth advocates to learn more about the products, know the issues, and learn how they can get involved. And then finally, ultimately what our local coalitions are doing is try to help raise awareness of what this means for local retailers and users and be able to get them the resources that are available to us. But we are also very eager and waiting for some of those supports hopefully to come through too, because ultimately we want to help.
Let's bring in Kathy now, joining us from Baldwin. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm wondering why they just don't shut down the whole vaping production until they figure this out. I'm guessing it's because Big Tobacco has enough money to stop that from happening.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Jenna, there have been more than 2,500 illnesses, over 50 deaths linked to vaping, according to the latest CDC data. What can be done?
So I cannot answer your question, Kathy, in terms of why this is still happening, because we know that people are getting sick. We know that people continue to be addicted. The bottom line is, too, is that, we know in Wisconsin that nearly 9 out of 10 Wisconsin youth wouldn't try these products if they were not flavored. So we have that information, and unfortunately, it's just out there. It's a product that's out there, and it keeps being sold. And there's a lot that has been done in Wisconsin related to tobacco prevention and control, but there's definitely more that we can do to address this epidemic.
Are you concerned, Jenna, that banning flavored e-cigarettes will make them more prevalent in non-regulated markets, in the black market?
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure. But what I can tell you is that the majority of users that are using these devices, that are using the flavored products, are youth.
You're in schools a lot. You're talking to young people. What is vaping like in schools these days, and as young as middle schools?
So I alluded to this earlier in that the kids really aren't the enemy. A lot of them are using because it's a coping mechanism. Just like with smoking, many users gravitate towards tobacco use because it's a stress reliever. It's a coping mechanism. And what we're hearing from a lot of these school resource officers is that this is an issue that's affecting many different populations and cliques within the district. It's not just affecting the bad kids per se. It's affecting, the kids that are in AP classes, that are active, that are athletes, and the kids that are, struggling too. And what we're really worried about is the kiddos with the genetic predisposition to addiction, because we know that these products are really priming their brain for use of other substances and behavioral challenges later down the road.
How are these vaping products, e-cigarettes, marketed to the children, the kids?
Well, I have to talk about the flavors, Kate, because, again, we know that 9 out of 10 Wisconsin youth wouldn't try the products if they weren't flavored. So if we know that those products are attractive to youth, I'm not sure why they're still being marketed that way. There has been some points brought up, though, that adults like flavors too. And while that may be true, we know that the majority of young users like them as well.
What are coalitions around the state doing to address the use of tobacco and vaping products among teens?
So really the coalitions across the state are working to increase health through education and advocacy, really creating a community environment that encourages tobacco and nicotine-free living. Our main job and goal is to really provide the people most affected by the issues the resources that they need to create a tobacco-free and nicotine-free life.
Jenna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate. I really appreciate it.
Jenna Flynn is health educator at the Marathon County Health Department, where she coordinates the Central Wisconsin Tobacco-Free Coalition. If you need help to quit smoking, vaping, or other tobacco use, as Jenna referred to, call the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line. That number is 800-784-8669. That's 800-784-8669. We also have a link to the Central Wisconsin Tobacco-Free Coalition on WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we head to Iowa to unpack caucus night, gather your reaction about what happened. No results yet. Our guide is a columnist with the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. We'll be back after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about last night's Iowa caucuses. The Iowa Democratic Party says it will release results sometime today. There were inconsistencies, they say, in reporting and they're hand-checking results. So what do you make of the situation in Iowa? Is this a harbinger of difficulties that come with new technologies? Democrats, what are your thoughts out of this delay, and how are you feeling right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Liz Lenz is a columnist and opinion writer for the Gazette newspaper in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. She's participated in the Iowa caucuses before. Liz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we woke up this morning with no results to speak of. What do you know? What is the latest here?
Well, the latest is that we don't know anything yet. Hopefully results will come later today. But with new rules and a new app and so many candidates in the field, and with there were supposed to be three counts that were going to come out of the caucuses. And what we're hearing from the party is that when they tallied those three counts, there were inconsistencies between the three of them. And that makes sense. Caucuses are long and complicated. People were really confused about the rules. There are reports that people were just kind of leaving their caucus once they thought they could, when that wasn't exactly true. So I'm sure that accounts for some of the inconsistencies in the numbers. It surely did in my precinct 15 in Cedar Rapids, where, you know, people left before they could fill out both sides of the presidential preference card, or a couple people tried to leave with their preference card. So and that happened at a bunch of precincts across the state as well.
So we're seeing some confusion out there. What were the three sets of data they were trying to manage here, trying to juggle?
Oh, wow. Get ready. So the first count was going to be the first number of, so when you caucus, you go, you stand in different groups, and then for your candidate. And if your group doesn't have 15% of the total of people who've gathered to caucus, then you're not viable and you have to realign. So that first number was just going to be the first count of people standing in groups. The second number was going to be the number after the realignment.
So after that 15% threshold is applied.
Yes, after that 15% threshold is applied. And so some groups like Yang, or, you know, the one person for Tom Steyer in my precinct, or whomever, would have to go to a different group. And so that second count would be that count with people in their different groups. And then the third count is how those counts go to delegates. So there's kind of some complicated math that portioned off, you know, so the numbers of people in the groups and how that meant with the delegate count. So, for example, in my precinct, we had, I think, 67 people for Bernie. We had 50 for Warren. Klobuchar barely met the viability count with 37. So did Biden, barely made it as well. And then Pete Buttigieg had quite a few, and we had 5 delegates to assign. And with the math, that meant that everybody got one.
Does it seem the Iowa Democratic Party was trying to do too much here? Was this getting too complicated?
Absolutely. I think the problem with the caucus is that it was designed to be exclusionary by nature. Early caucuses in the 1850s were basically just meetings people would set up real fast to appoint delegates. And they wanted to do it in a way so that people couldn't come, so that they couldn't get delegates for their own candidate. I mean, it was a bad, corrupt system then, but that's how it evolved. It started out as this kind of secretive, exclusionary thing, and it's just continued to evolve that way. And the party tried really hard to make it open and accessible, especially coming out of 2016 when there were a lot of confusion out of our caucus system. But we just weren't able to do it because, adding new rules, adding in these preference cards just took what was already confusing and exclusionary and just added, just dumped some gasoline on that and lit it all on fire.
We're talking with Liz Lenz. She is a columnist for the Gazette newspaper in Cedar Rapids. And we're recapping her experience last night taking part in the Iowa caucuses. What are your thoughts on the delay and the problems in Iowa this morning? How badly do you think these issues in Iowa will impact the Democrats? How late did you stay up waiting for results? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Liz, you alluded to this, but there were a number of new caucus rules set in place this year. What were these rules and where did they come in at which point?
The rules have been in the process for a while now because a couple of things is coming out of 2016, there were a lot of questions and a lot of confusion about how delegates got appointed. Some people were saying, well, maybe Bernie Sanders had quote unquote won the popular vote, but didn't win the delegate count, kind of the electoral college thing all over again. So the party really tried hard to put into place counting mechanisms. So that's where some of the new math for deciding delegates came, because in a lot of places in 2016, between two hotly contested candidates, that came out to a coin flip. The party wanted to do a little better because, as you can imagine, as a candidate, you don't want your chances to come down to a coin flip.
Right. You've been campaigning in Iowa all year long, and this can't come down to a coin flip.
No, it shouldn't come down to a coin flip at all. But, like you heard out of my precinct, we had 5 really strong groups and 5 delegates to appoint. So it worked out with the math. But you can imagine if we'd had one less delegate to appoint, how that math would have worked out. It would have been a nightmare, and I think it was in a lot of precincts. So that was the genesis for some of the rules, and they've been in the process for a while. Another new rule was having satellite caucus locations, and that's been in the process for many, many years, not just out of 2016. They were kind of tested in 2016 and then rolled out in full force.
Scotland, Glasgow, Scotland, yeah. Paris, another satellite spot, Milwaukee in the mix as well.
Yes. We need to get all of our Iowans in Wisconsin a chance to be enfranchised. Yes, and there were lots at nursing homes and colleges. There were a couple that happened earlier in the day so people could attend. I think the hope with those was that it helped give voice to more people, but that just didn't happen. Early numbers for voter participation saw that we are about on level with 2016 numbers, which was about 15% of registered voters in the state participated. So this is not a lot of people participating in this. And yet it's still frustrating.
Well, let's take a call now. Jonathan in Madison is with us. Hi, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm an Iowa native, but I live in Wisconsin now, and I've been through a couple caucuses in my life, and I was a precinct co-captain for one of them. And I think there's a lot of cool things about the caucus and having people in your community come around and talk about their candidate and kind of encourage others to come to their side if they're not viable. But I haven't seen, you know, the turnout numbers recently, so this is just kind of a theory. But from what I hear from family and everything who are still there, it seems like voter turnout is on the rise and definitely was last time. And in my opinion, I think having more people there complicates the process even more. And so I'm starting to wonder if Iowa is kind of growing out of the caucus format just because more people have taken interest in voting.
Jonathan, thank you for those insights. So Jonathan saw the caucuses been part of once where it was more about community and camaraderie, and now they're getting really big, Liz.
Well, we're not seeing that played out in the numbers. The voter turnout was 15% this time around. That's what it was like in 2016. The biggest caucus turnout we had was in 2008 with just over 16%. So I'm not sure if it's exactly becoming as big as we actually want it. We want it to be more open. We want it to be more accessible. And it just is failing to do that. And yes, turnout can be big at some precincts, and what happens then with the new rules is it just becomes harder and harder to control a room full of 300 people where you have to hand them each a ballot or a presidential preference card. We can't call it a ballot. New Hampshire gets really mad about that. you know, you have to hand them a card. You have to do complicated math, you know, in a room full of 300 people, and that's what I think we're seeing in this cycle, is these new rules really hampering what was coming out of the caucuses. Also, there was supposed to be a smartphone app that was supposed to make reporting easier, and the app just did not work at all. So people were trying to call in the results, and the results weren't being, and they were being put on hold for a really long time. So I think it's less about who shows up and more about how this process was managed.
It's Morning After the Iowa Caucuses with Liz Lenz as our guide. She's a columnist for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. What were some of the things you were watching for last night? How do you feel about the results not coming in? What confuses you about the process? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Liz Lenz here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about last night's Iowa caucuses. The state's Democrats, they gathered in rooms across the state and remotely in satellite locations in far-flung cities like Paris and Glasgow, Scotland, signaling their support for the candidates hoping to face President Trump in November. The results did not come in as expected. There is hand-checking results today. There was trouble with the app rollout. What do you think about these hiccups? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Liz Lenz stays with us. She's an opinion writer for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. Let's bring in another call now. Dwayne is joining us from Wausau. Hi, Dwayne.
Oh, good morning. You know, this, the last thing they needed was this to happen, you know, putting fuel on the fire for you know, Trump is already on the line saying this is going to be a big victory for him. But I caucused three times in Iowa back in the 90s and back when President Obama was. And it is kind of cool, but it's a big time grab. You're there all night. It's not private. I mean, you're all in a corner, and then if your candidate isn't viable or gets a certain percent, then you're cajoled into going into some other candidate. And, you know, it's, I can see them not letting Iowa, the DNC,
be first anymore, or maybe even them going to a primary in the future. I just, you know, it's just, it's a debacle, and it's a shame it happened.
Dwayne, thank you. Yeah, thank you for those thoughts. Liz, what might be the reaction from the DNC here?
Well, I think your caller is hitting on something correct here. It's that in this cycle, Iowa was particularly fighting for its relevance. We heard Julian Castro criticize the caucus process. I think everyone was trying really hard to answer the question, why does Iowa get to go first? And I don't think we answered it very well. And I know there's a lot of concern that maybe we won't have our first in this nation status anymore, because the kind of deal is we were supposed to be this first in the nation caucus, which just happened by accident. And then New Hampshire's the first in the nation primary. And I think that's one of the reasons Iowa hasn't been fully able to change, because if we become a primary, then we upset New Hampshire's first in the nation primary status. So that's always been this kind of really tense push and pull that's made Iowa incapable of changing in some of the ways we need to change. So now that this has been an entire mess, what do we do? I think people here are really concerned we might lose our caucuses. But, you know, there are some people here also saying, well, if that means the process is more democratic, then take it, because we need more democracy here in America. But as far as, you know, what happens with the president's rhetoric, I think that in some ways, you know, he was going to criticize this no matter what happened. And you know, now he'll, you know, just do what he does best.
A number of the Democratic candidates, former Vice President Joe Biden, Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, all gave speeches last night that seemed to proclaim or at least hint at their victory. Many of the candidates have now left for New Hampshire. Here's former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg feeling that victory.
By all indications, we are going on to New Hampshire victorious.
And then here's Senator Bernie Sanders' optimism at the podium last night.
I imagine, have a strong feeling that at some point the results will be announced. And when those results are announced, I have a good feeling we're going to be doing very, very well here in Iowa.
So, Liz, what should we take away from the speeches last night?
Well, when there's no winners, everybody can claim victory. I think that they gave speeches to fire up their base and move on to New Hampshire. These candidates don't have much time to sit around and tally presidential preference cards. They want to keep some forward momentum. They want to go, and they're out now. They're on the East Coast. Getting this, you know, next part of the process off. So I think their speeches were just trying to keep up that momentum there. And, you know, and again, it's easy to claim victory when there isn't a clear winner. I think it's also probably safe to say that when the results do come out, there will be three different ways for three different people to claim some sort of victory. So they might not even have to, you know, finesse their victory speeches. You know, Klobuchar might be able to say, oh, well, I did better than I expected. You know, Sanders can say, oh, look, it's neck and neck with Elizabeth Warren. And Pete felt really confident. I'm not sure exactly what he knows that the rest of us don't. But, you know, but there we go. No winners. Everybody claims victory. We move on to New Hampshire.
Liz Lenz, a columnist for the Gazette newspaper in Cedar Rapids, is our guide as we recap the Iowa caucuses from last night. Still awaiting results, expected sometime today. Let's take Tom now in Cedarburg with thoughts on Iowa last night. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I'm glad to see you're doing some political shows. I think it's about time that that Wisconsin and other states have a chance to be first, and that the states rotate through who would be the first state to be counted. And I think that Iowa has been the first for way too long, and you can see that by the policies that these people who are now president have pushed through, like gas alcohol, all this beef.
So, Tom, who should be first in your mind? What state should be first?
How about Wisconsin?
How about Wisconsin? All right, Liz. You know, Tom is saying that Iowa should no longer be the first state here.
Well, if it was Wisconsin, I'm sure the candidates would really enjoy some good beer and cheese curds.
fair enough. Fair.
Not to pander, but there is discussion, right, of why Iowa, why anybody, and the answer is who knows. Democracy is a mess and it's complicated, and it can certainly change, and I think it will change going forward. But which state? I don't know. It's hard to say. Maybe no state should go first. Maybe we should just do a nationwide primary, you know, that happens in the spring or even earlier, so that, you know, this presidential race doesn't keep going forever.
Well, when you look demographically, though, Iowa isn't much like the rest of the country. Des Moines, the largest city with a population of just 217,000, residents are more than 90% white. How can we apply Iowa's results to the rest of the nation?
Well, that's another thing. Iowa hasn't ever been particularly good at picking the president. Democratic-wise, yes, we're okay there mostly. Obama came out of Iowa, and I think that's one of the things that people point to when they say, but look, you know, a small candidate with not a lot of name recognition came to Iowa, won, and America got its first black president. But I don't think, you know, the Obama reason justifies what we're seeing right now in 2020. We haven't ever been particularly good at picking the president. And I think people are losing on the answers as to why Iowa first. So somebody else take it next. I've heard a lot of talk about how Illinois demographically and racially is more reflective of the rest of the nation. Maybe them. There is a concern, though, that you'd want to pick a place where retail politics were important, where you couldn't just go in, do a big ad buy, and have that be the way that you win. Because I think one of the reasons Iowa's been able to hang on to this for so long is that we can say you can be small, you don't have a lot of money, and you can come out of Iowa a winner. But I think that's less and less proving to be not quite as true.
Liz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Liz Lenz is a columnist and opinion writer for the Gazette newspaper in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. She was at her local high school caucus. She's been describing the process and her feelings about this political tradition. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.